You know, the mythical stature of Marco Polo, I think, is deceptive. It's like quicksand because it's so freighted with legends and inaccuracies. For example, bringing back pasta, just for starters. And yet the real story is so much more illuminating. In other words, the things that he really did bring back and why.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum with author Lawrence Berggren, discussing his book Marco Polo. I'm Eugenio Menegon, assistant professor of Chinese history at Boston University. In his new book, Marco Polo, author Lawrence Berggren looks back at one of the best documented early journeys from the West to China to retell the well-known story of a Kalo youth of 17 traveling with his father and uncle to Asia in 1271. There, he lived in the court of Kublai Khan for 24 years, eventually returning to Venice with knowledge of the latest inventions, with great stories, and with wealth. What were the personal qualities that made Marco Polo the earliest bridge between East and West? How did his book, The Travels, recorded by a fellow prisoner in the Genoese jail, come to have such a big impact on future historians and travelers? A graduate of Harvard University, Lawrence Berggren is the author of many acclaimed biographies and histories, including the most recent, Over the Edge of the World, Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe. He has also written biographies of James Agee, Louis Armstrong, Al Capone, and Irving Berlin, each considered definitive. Welcome to Cambridge Forum, Larry Berggren.
Thank you very much. We're going to talk a little bit about Marco Polo tonight, and although this is a book which takes place mostly in the 13th century, the deeper I got into it during my own four-year journey in search of Marco Polo and his travels, the more it seemed to me that this was, in an oblique way, really a book about today and in Marco Polo's world, although it seems so far away and so removed from us in time and in language and custom. By the end, it seemed to me, was not really that different, and I'm going to try and explain to you why, and that I think we can find keys to many global problems and conundrums that we're facing in this very, very complex and many-chambered book. Now, people weren't sure really until the 19th century about much of what Marco Polo said. Was it fact or was it fiction? In fact, he was taken to be a fabulist. That was a popular travel genre at the time he wrote, and it was assumed that Marco Polo, and partly because of his embellishments and partly because of people's expectations, was doing the same thing. In fact, he was writing a travelogue, a sort of a supercharged travelogue. Marco Polo actually didn't write these travels. He dictated them to a ghostwriter named Rusticello, who came from Pisa. Rusticello was a romance writer, Manchet, and he wrote as Marco Polo dictated to him when they were both in a jail in Genoa. Actually, it was really a palazzo, and they were kept there as captives over a period of perhaps a year. And then afterwards, Marco Polo made changes and corrections and additions to this manuscript. Keep in mind, this was before the invention of movable type in Western Europe, so manuscripts were the only way to go. And on top of all that, there are dozens of Marco Polo manuscripts, early ones, maybe as many as 100, and yet there's no one authentic original manuscript. And they're drastically different from one another, not just in language, not just because one's in Gaelic and one's in Tuscan and one's in French and another's in Latin. Some are twice as long as others, and some tell very different stories from others. Unlike our idea of an explorer, he did not decide to go explore China. And I don't know how many times I read that Marco Polo discovered China. He was one of many countless merchants from not only all over Europe, but all over what we would now call the Middle East, who were taking some branch of what we now call the Silk Road, some trail into Asia to trade with the Mongols. The Mongols under the leadership of Genghis Khan, who was the grandfather of Kublai Khan, had conquered China and made the Silk Road safe for travel. And Kublai Khan invited Westerners, like the Polos, in, allowed them to trade, but wanted them to administer his huge, far-flung empire. The Mongols were wonderful warriors, and they were fabulous on horseback. They were able to ride a horse at a full gallop, facing backward, and fire arrows one after another against their enemies. And they were able to conquer all of Asia and a good part of Europe, all the way to the banks of the Danube River. It was thought at that time that they would keep going, but they stopped there. So Kublai Khan, as a result, wound up becoming the emperor of a loose federation that was the largest land-based empire in history. Yet there weren't enough people to administer it, which is why Europeans like the Polos, or many Arabs as well, came in handy as tax collectors, particularly, and in just sort of eyes and ears, spies, if you will, for Kublai Khan. Marco's father and uncle, Niccolo and Maffeo, had gone on a trip before him and met Kublai Khan, and he gave them an order to come back to the capital city, which is in the location of Beijing now, but was called Kambulak, with 100 wise men from Europe. He basically wanted to pick their brains for science, for any kind of knowledge, for military knowledge, natural sciences, anything you could imagine. Well, they agreed to do that just so they could leave, but of course they had no idea how to do that. Instead, they brought back their one son, Marco, who was only 17 at the time. Now, they had been gone for 16 years when they returned to Venice from their first trip without him. So he was virtually a stranger to them and vice versa. And after a brief time in Venice, they brought him along, this son who really didn't know who they were, on the second trip to Kublai Khan. It's the second trip, which is the one that was immortalized in the book and the one that Marco, much later in prison, wrote about. But he went as a kid, and he went because his uncle and father dragged him there. Otherwise, he would have spent his life in some part of Venice. And as a merchant of Venice, which is what he eventually became when he returned. However, this proved to be the most extraordinary education experience that anybody ever had, and Marco Polo came of age on the Silk Road with all its hardships and all its rigors. Travel at that time was agonizingly slow. You either went on foot or on horseback or by donkey cart. Occasionally you sailed, but that was extraordinarily dangerous, and people avoided the water at all cost. Boats were very unsafe, and Marco had some near brushes himself on the way home. So it was considered safer to go over land, but it took years, at least 3 years, but sometimes 4 or 5 years, to get all the way from Venice to Beijing or Kambulak. So it was a very, very serious undertaking to do this. Why did people go? They went to get rich. They went because Kublai Khan let them trade on the side. And as soon as they hit Afghanistan, they could begin trading in rubies and other precious stones, and later on in spices and silk and other fabrics. There were an endless number of things to be traded in. And skilled merchants like the Polos, Marco and his father and uncle, or Marco gradually learned how to become one himself, could enrich themselves along the way. And eventually they transferred their wealth into the form of gems, which they could sew into their garments. And so that was a portable form of wealth, because of course there was no such thing as a bank that they could deal with at that time. Marco, if you read his book as a merchant's view of Asia at that time, it's a way to understand it, because although he missed many things which seem so vitally important to us, for example, printing in China, not to mention all sorts of scientific and astronomical developments, and cultural and literary things, completely went over his head. As a merchant, he did understand fabrics and gems and other items, pelts and skins and tusks that people traded in on the Silk Road. So he had his own particular perspective. It was not particularly an intellectual one. And he was also, because he was a young man, fascinated by the women and marital customs of the various areas that he went through. One of his most widely disbelieved stories was going through remote towns in what would now be one of the stands, we're not exactly sure which, where the husbands would invite travelers such as the Polos to stay as their guests, which was fine, and not only that, but to stay with their wives, and they would then leave them alone with their wives for several days. And Marco found this astounding, but wrote about this custom in considerable detail. This was the kind of tall tale and bawdy tale that was disbelieved for centuries in his book. However, in the 19th century, when anthropologists and others came into China, they discovered that what Marco Polo wrote wasn't fantasy, it was largely fact, including customs like that. And one can speculate that the reason was that these very isolated towns were suffering from a depleted gene pool and had evolved an adaptation to refresh the gene pool, which was to entice travelers, the few travelers who did come through, to come in and contribute some genetic material to this depleted gene pool. Marco could not believe what he was seeing, and when people read his account years later, they could not believe what they were reading. And yet, as ethnologists and anthropologists and travelers closer to the modern era discovered, it was all true. And those customs, or remnants of those customs, were still going on at the time that Marco, at the time they were there, 100 centuries after Marco. So the value of his book is really a record of a period in history which was, in many ways, far advanced over Europe, which was tumultuous, which represented an interpenetration of Western and Mongol and Chinese cultures all at once. And he was there to write it down, plus to give a personal fly-on-the-wall view of the most powerful ruler in history, who was Kublai Khan, which is what makes his book so fascinating, what I think makes many of the scholarly and linguistic problems as unresolvable as many of them are worth dealing with. You may just briefly, I'll tell you very briefly why he wound up in jail. He got back to Venice when he was 41, and after a while he got bored. He didn't get married right away, as was expected of him. One could surmise that he had had a lot of adventures in Europe, and the strictures of a conventional marriage in Venice was not to his liking. He went off to war. There was a constant battle between Venice and its rival city-state, Genoa. As a commander, and he was captured by the Genoese, and that's how he happened to be placed in a jail, really a kind of house arrest when he got to Genoa, and happened to be placed with Rustichello, who wrote down his account because he had made a large impression on people by telling his stories. Now, if not for this quirk of fate, nobody would have remembered Marco Polo. For example, his father and uncle made two trips all the way to China and Kambulak, and we don't almost nothing about them because they didn't write down their accounts. As the professor mentioned, other people have also written accounts. Marco is the best known and the most flamboyant in the West, but in the Muslim world, Ibn Battuta wrote a very similar account of his travels 30 or 40 years later. There was even a Marco Polo in reverse named Rabban Soma, who was a Nestorian Christian monk who went from Manchuria along the Silk Road to Paris and to Rome. At the same time, Marco Polo was heading east. And he also wrote an account of his experiences. So there are actually many Marco Polos out there from different backgrounds and persuasions, all giving their impressions of what was actually a very exciting and tumultuous time in history. So anyway, I'll open it up to questions and discussions.
Thank you very much for your words.
Thank you.
You're joining us at Cambridge Forum, listening to Loren Berggren discussing his book, Marco Polo. So if I can follow up with a question, then
sure.
You are also the author of a biography of Magellan.
Yes.
How would you compare the two?
Magellan was a much more difficult, tragic figure. He's fits our idea of a modern explorer because he had a goal. He was going to circumnavigate the globe. He was going to find a shortcut to bring spices back. He was going to give Spain, for which he sailed, even though he's Portuguese, a tremendous commercial advantage. So he was, we can understand that because he was very goal-directed. Marco Polo was, in his medieval way, was perhaps more of an existentialist. And he was certainly much more of like an open system. And he took things as they came, and he did not make things happen. Magellan made things happen and paid for it with his life because he eventually got involved in a unnecessary war in the Philippines with some indigenous peoples there, and they killed him. Marco never killed anybody, but did find ways to ingratiate himself wherever he went. Partly but through the language of commerce, because that he found that that was a universal language. And wherever he went, people, no matter how warlike, no matter how belligerent they were, wanted to trade, needed to trade. They were fascinated by whatever they could buy. Partly it was the novelty. Partly it was just getting a hold of things that they needed. For example, salt, which he was an intensely traded substance and really became like money. The same with silk. Very, very important thing that became virtually currency, as well as all the other more conventional uses that we think of it. So, in a sense, for him, the universal language as a merchant was commerce. I think there's a lesson in that for today.
Thank you. So, welcome again to Cambridge Forum with author Lawrence Berggren as we continue our discussion of his book, Marco Polo, and the ways this 13th century Venetian traveler forever altered the European view of the world. At this point in the program, we'll take questions from the audience.
I was wondering if you could speak a little longer about the controversy about whether Marco Polo did go to China or not. I know Francis Wood is probably the biggest proponent of this.
Right.
You know, European historians sort of universally come down on the side of, oh yes, he definitely went. And Chinese historians seem to be unanimous in saying, oh no, he didn't, we have the records, his name doesn't show up in the administration. And I was wondering if you could talk about not only your own personal perspective on what might objectively be true, mm-hmm. but why the lines are drawn in those ways, sort of, it seems to matter what culture you are approaching the story from, what truth you wind up with.
Yeah, actually, the Chinese think he did go also. And he wrote at a time when many travel stories, especially the one by Sir John Mandeville, were bogus. And people would claim to have traveled all over Asia, China, wherever they went. And they just went to a library and they put together tales from antiquity. So it was natural for people to assume that Marco Polo, with his fantastic tales, was doing very much the same thing. Also, there was very little way to verify, until the 19th century, what he was writing about. And as I said earlier, a lot of it struck people as being incredible. And so they thought that he had a very good imagination. Even the things that he brought back with him from China, such as coal and paper money, and gunpowder and scientific instruments did not register with the Venetians because they couldn't see a use for it. For example, coal, you would think, well, who couldn't understand that? But at that time in Western Europe, they were using peat and wood for fuel, not coal. Coal came later on. So the inventions that he brought back, although, well, many other people were bringing them back as well, actually didn't transfer easily to Western Europe. They had to be invented all over again, the printing press being the best example. Gutenberg invented the printing press several hundred years after the Chinese had printing. Now, it was not the same kind of printing because there's too many Chinese characters. The Chinese printing was more like stencils or blocks. Nevertheless, it was, you know, fits our definition of printing. In the 19th century, When other people got into China, they realized that a lot of what Marco Polo said made sense. But there was still a persistent kind of contra tradition that Marco Polo didn't go and that he had borrowed from other travelers. He got some extra help inadvertently from his collaborator, Rusticello, who was only too happy to embellish. So if you were looking for things that were not true, they tended to be the interpolations for Rustichello. But then several things occurred in more modern scholarship. There was a Chinese scholar who died recently named Wan Qichu, who discovered some Chinese annals that tallied exactly with some elements of Marco Polo's story. And although he didn't name the Polos, it described it with such specificity what these three Europeans did and their missions that it could only be Marco Polo. Furthermore, the leading antagonist, if you will, Frances Woods, her arguments have been debunked by a lot of scholars. For example, to just take the most obvious one, how could Marco Polo have gone to China and not written about the Great Wall of China? But the answer is quite simple. It hadn't been built yet. It was built in the Ming Dynasty. But the same thing goes for tea. How could he have gone to China and not mentioned tea? But he did. In some of the manuscripts, he writes about tea. So I could go on, you know, point by point, but you sort of get the general drift.
You traveled to write this book. You retraced Marco Polo's route. Will you talk about that? Did you walk and take donkey carts in 3 years? Or how did you travel, and what did you learn by retracing that route?
This subject is so vast that one can easily spend 24 years, like Marco, trying to retrace his steps. But in my own case, because I was trying to do this book in a reasonable amount of time and keep it a reasonable length, I made one trip to China, going back and forth across the length of China, which was a fairly extensive trip, then another trip across back and forth Mongolia, another trip to Venice for more research there, and then the other trips, which were just as important, were trips to the library. That would be the East Asian Library here, the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University, Butler Library, Columbia University, and other specialized or semi-specialized collections. And what I did on some of these trips, some of it was sightseeing, simply seeing sites that Marco Polo described. It's kind of a now and then comparison, and often being struck by the similarities. Sometimes it was meeting scholars who really don't have much of a voice in the West. So I was able to meet scholars in Beijing and in Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital of Mongolia, and talk with them about their Marco Polo perspectives. They not only believe that Marco Polo was there, they sort of need Marco Polo as a symbol to be there to validate that part of the world in the eyes of the West. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. In the past few years, the Chinese government has endorsed Marco Polo as an important figure, and they've begun erecting big statues of him. And there's a very prominent one that I visited in Hangzhou, which was at one point the capital of the Song Dynasty in China. And it's new, and it's very striking to have a statue of a foreigner in a location like that. It's almost like having a statue of a foreigner in the Washington Mall. It would be, you know, there would be a very good reason for that statue to be there. So I think the Chinese at this point would like to promote the idea that Marco Polo went to China and spoke well of China. But there's a certain irony there, because Marco Polo didn't know that much about China. China was strange to him. He didn't speak Chinese. And he was with the Mongols. He was with the occupying army of the Mongols. And it was the Mongols with whom he felt affinity. If you read carefully his writings about the so-called City of Heaven, which is our modern-day Hangzhou, it often baffled him. And he wrote about it, but it was as he was suddenly stepping out and writing as a stranger, as an outsider, rather than someone who, with the Mongols, felt a sense of connection. I think that had come to him through his father and uncle, and also through the fact that he was a personal envoy of the Mongol emperor, Kublai Khan.
I believe you started saying that there were many parallels to today and his travels. And I wondered if you wanted to say more about that.
Well, you know, this is sort of in the eye of the beholder and what you make of it, but it seemed to me that he discovered some universals of human interaction. The fact that commerce seemed to cut across all political boundaries. The fact that the biggest boundaries that he encountered really were not geographical or even political so much as matters of faith, that these seem to be the kind of arbitrary and unchangeable lines that he was dealing with. As a person of, I wouldn't say no faith, but changeable faith, Marco was able in his chameleon-like way to fit into some of these different areas, at least temporarily. But, you know, it was certainly something that was very reminiscent of what's going on today. When he talks about Afghanistan and how dangerous it is and all the highwaymen and the fact that it was the poppy-growing center of the world and there are lots of rubies there, this is all Afghanistan today. Very little has changed. And you can find people who live pretty much the same way. So it's not just that he was looking forward, although he did that in some ways, he was also looking backward to examples of people living in more primitive ways or simpler ways. In Mongolia today, it's not that hard to go out of Ulaanbaatar and find yourself, as I did, staying in a Gur camp and seeing sights that he described and being transported into a very different world from what we think of as the present. But after a while, you start thinking, well, what is the present anyway? The present is where you happen to be. So, you know, that's why I think his book is so unbelievably rich, because it's almost like tree rings or, you know, a layer of the earth with different geological sections that are still in his book. You know, they're interacting. They're not inert. And that gives it a lot of confusion, but a lot of energy.
There was a thread, I think, in many of the questions tonight, asking about Marco Polo's relevance to today's world. Yes. And asking also about Marco Polo as a mythical figure. You yourself have seen the statue of Marco Polo in Hangzhou, and you have commented that the Chinese probably are putting that statue out today because he represents commercial connections with the rest of the world. And that's what China is all about today, capitalist development. So what would you say about this mythical stature of Marco Polo today?
Well, the mythical stature of Marco Polo, I think, is deceptive. It's like quicksand because it's so freighted with legends and inaccuracies. For example, bringing back pasta, just for starters. And yet the real story is so much more illuminating, in other words, the things that he really did bring back and why. But he's always going to be tantalizing because we're never going to know. He's, in a sense, a seminal figure like Shakespeare. We're never going to know enough about him to say, oh, yes, we have the full story. We know what he did every week of his life. We just aren't going to. We don't have the documents. And so that's intriguing and makes us work harder to fill in some of those gaps. It can also lead one astray, I suppose. But I think, it makes him a figure of fascination because, as I said, he's not the only person who wrote about his adventures, and yet he's the first one who comes to mind.
Well, thank you so much, Larry Berggren, for your presentation
and
your discussion.
Thank you.
You have been listening to a program of Cambridge Forum, recorded in October 2007. For more information about this radio program entitled Marco Polo, featuring author Lawrence Berggren, or about our ongoing radio series, visit us on the web at cambridgeforum.org. In Harvard Square, I'm Eugenio Menegon. Thanks for joining us.